Next time you're trying to think of a great gift to give someone, put down the scholar stone and log on to sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you within Canada or the United States within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or like I suggested, as a thoughtful gift, or you can join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
TOP 100.
TOP 100.
TOP 100.
Project.
And action.
Yobuseo and Kamsabnida. I think I got those right. Korean for hello and thank you for downloading the 186th episode of The Next 100 Project. That sounds weird, doesn't it? Never should have numbered this thing. The Every Monday Classic Movies Podcast. If you're curious to hear what we said about the 123 pictures that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007, more numbers, top 100, more numbers, lists, they're all the way back in our archives. Fair warning now, we spoil. I'm the basement dweller who gets jobs for his whole family, and that works out perfectly, forever and ever. And Eva, wrong movie. Ryan Ellis. And here's the lying art therapist who uses peaches as weapons and prefers not to be stabbed at backyard barbecues. My award-nominated wife, Bev.
That's me.
The inside joke continues. We will explain that at some point, one day. Okay, another disclaimer before we get going any further. We are still using the Yeti microphone, of course, but now we've got it different positioned. We've done some tests, we've tried to improve the audio, and we're going to do some more tests and make some changes, probably for the next episode. So if you wonder why things keep on sounding different, this is why. I'm not liking the hum I heard, or buzz, wherever it was, on a few of those recent episodes. I think it was your computer making those noises. Stupid.
My computer's such a jerk.
Now it's covered by a big comforter. So improved audio, we hope, is in the very near future. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. The very recently, in fact, a month ago today, award-winning, Oscar-winning, in fact, Parasite. Of the directors who won 3 Oscars in one night, so that's directors, because of course Disney won 4 in one night, but he wasn't a director. How many of those guys were nominated for the first time ever in any category that night?
I found just one other, obviously Bong Joon-ho, but also James L. Brooks, who won for Terms of Endearment in 1984.
You missed a big one. The most famous name of the three of them.
Who?
James Cameron.
Oh, my God.
Cameron had never been nominated for anything until Titanic, when he won for picture director and editing. You mentioned Brooks won for picture director and I think the adapted screenplay for his first movie as well. It wasn't Cameron's first movie, obviously, Titanic. And now we're going to call him Pong because apparently it is. We questioned that on the Oscars post show. And apparently Spike Lee and Keanu Reeves, who said Pong when they talked about him for various awards, had it right. Although if we say Bong or other people say Bong, and they will for a while, then that's just the way it is.
Well, but let's just say right now, obviously our pronunciation is going to be horrific.
Of all the names.
Yeah. We usually try pretty hard to get the names right, but we're not going to work that hard to get the names right. We're just going to work hard to express ourselves in a way that we think people will understand, because there's a lot of characters and they all have Korean names. And I feel like most of our listeners are probably English speakers, so it's going to be a lot easier to describe a character as the mother of the Kim family or the son in the Park family.
Mother Kim. Well, I'll try to do names the best I can, but also try to be clear at the same time. But anyway, yeah, the big reason to do this movie right now is because Bong Joon-ho and his cast and crew, well, he mostly took them home, but 4 Oscars. And it's 4 because in a way he won for international feature, but really it goes to the movie, but the director always accepts it. Alfonso Cuarón just in last year's show did the same thing. He won Best Director and Cinematography, right? I think so. And then they gave him that award, but if you look on IMDb, it's not really his award. So anyway, it's hard to figure. Okay, Ji-Zeng Chung? That's the Korean name for this movie. Parasite won the Palme d'Or at Cannes last May. Then it was screened at just about every festival in existence over the next few months before being released over here in October 2019. And what a success story it's been. It's now passed the $200 million mark worldwide. And it's 56th currently at the 2019 U.S. box office and gaining, because when I took my notes for this about a week ago, it was 65th or something like that. So it's gained that many spots in just a matter of a few days, and it's going to gain on whatever it's behind. Maybe it already has since I last looked at Box Office Mojo.
It's probably not a lot of other 2019 movies that are still gaining on this list. Well, most of them have plateaued out.
It got an expansion after it won the Oscars, which almost always happens for a Best Picture winner, and sometimes for even just nominees.
Parasite had the biggest post-Oscar boost in box office since Gladiator, the film we covered 2 weeks ago.
All right, Bev, for those who maybe don't know anything about Parasite but are listening to us anyway, or just to refresh everyone's memory, what is this movie about?
Meet the Kim family. Bright, hardworking, and resourceful, but woefully underemployed and struggling in Seoul, Korea. They use a connection to infiltrate the home of the Parks, a wealthy and guileless family who get tricked into hiring all four of the Kims for lucrative service jobs. But everything falls apart when the ousted housekeeper returns to reveal that her husband has been hiding for years, going mad, in the Parks' secret underground bunker. A bloody battle for leverage ensues under the Parks' noses until it finally explodes and positively ruins a perfectly lovely birthday party.
It's Panic Room without David Fincher, isn't it? In some ways, at least. It is a Panic Room. That's what it's supposed to be for. And that's a twist I did not at all see coming in any way.
No one blew it for me. I knew there was going to be a twist, that amazing tracking shot when she's going down the stairs. I was like, what is happening?
I don't think I'd even heard there was a twist. I don't recall going to it. Maybe you'd heard there was a twist, but I didn't even know that much, and I would not have predicted what the twist was. Or in a nutshell, do you think the Kims got fired? The mother and the son?
If the driver gets fired for leaving a pair of panties in the backseat of the car, what do you think happens to people who kill the patriarch of the family?
Well, he was the hard ass, and now he's dead. Maybe the mother's gonna be nicer.
Yeah, right. She's the soft touch. She's not the soft touch of the two of them at all.
Right, but I just thought that was fun to speculate upon what happens to them. Because, well, then again, when we saw it for the second time on our Blu-ray just a couple of days ago, we agreed definitely that the whole ending has to be a complete fantasy from the father's point of view, because he doesn't see it happen, although he sees his son get carried out during the chaos of that backyard barbecue. But the son got that rock. Well, first of all, he was hit with, what was it again? He was hit one time.
Scholar's rock. It's called the scholar's rock.
But then the guy in the basement, Jen Say, the panic room dweller, he hits him twice, but the second time, you see the fingers twitching. Ki Woo has got to be dead, but the father doesn't know that. So maybe even that much is not true, and the only person who survived is the mother, who's the last one to get a job. And once they all do get jobs, she's the one that has, if you think about it, the most access to the family. Because she's maybe not always there, but she's generally, like, she must be living maid, right? So she must always be there. The two tutors in the Kim family, the son and the daughter, wouldn't really be in the house that often. And their father would be a decent amount of the time, quite a bit of the time, because he's a driver. He'd be around them a lot, but the mother would be around them the most, and she's the one that got the job last.
But I just want to clarify, you talk about how we have this theory, this movie's ending is a little bit of a Taxi Driver ending, but the fantasy begins when Mr. Kim goes into the basement to hide from the police. All the stuff you're describing, in my opinion, they really happen in the movie. And then the movie implies that there is a fantasy sequence, which is obviously a fantasy sequence, which is, I'll call him Kevin, but the Kim son. Kevin is describing his fantasy of how he's going to work really hard and he's going to get an amazing job. He's going to earn all this money. He's going to buy the house and then his father will be able to just walk up. And
Excuse me 1 second. Buy that house?
Well, Bong Joon-ho said that it would take him 564 years to save up enough money to buy that house.
So it could happen then.
Oh, yeah,
so you're saying there's a chance.
But it's a fantasy, right? And then the movie does this great little trick ending where it ends on this long, slow fade out of the Park home where they're all being reunited and it's the happy ending. And then it pops back up and we're in the semi-basement apartment and the camera pans down. There's this whole theme of physically going down, going downstairs, going down hills, and of course, it's a metaphor for class. So the last thing the camera does is it pans from that semi-basement window to all the way underground, and then we see Kevin's face finishing the letter. So of course, that's a fantasy, his fantasy of making the money and buying the house, but we're saying that it's actually more of a Taxi Driver thing where everything that happens after Mr. Kim goes into the basement is all in Mr. Kim's head. Because, as you said, it really is implied that Kevin is dead.
How can he not be?
the amount of blood from that injury, I know it's not impossible and it's cinema. And I actually haven't seen anything in the interviews that I saw with Bong Joon-ho to imply that it is a fantasy. I think this is a little bit like my Vertigo theory. But I think it works that everything that happens after that moment is just the fantasy of Mr. Kim, because he has no idea what happened. He doesn't know how injured Kevin was.
Or that he was injured.
But he knows that Jessica died, which is why he, and even his fantasy is like, well, Jessica's gone, but you were fine. He just had a concussion. He recovered. You got probation. And now he can even hear me talk to him and I can have this communication with him. But it's such a fantasy to even imply that they got away, that Kevin is alive.
The father using Morse code at the end, which he assumes the son will see. And he does say in the voiceover that he'll just do this every night and maybe eventually the son will see it. Okay,
I guess I can understand that. Eventually the new family will call an electrician.
When it happens that often, if you saw light flickering a little bit, but also in a weird way, it wouldn't be this typical kind of flicker the way the light in our laundry room does, where it does that horror room, and it comes on properly. Doesn't sound like that, but you get my point. But there's a lot of themes in this movie, and one of them is that we have the Wi-Fi theme in the beginning, where they're just trying to get connection that way. And at the end, we go back to something that's hundreds of years old, communication tactic with Morse code.
Oh, great point.
And another touch in that is the kids are trying to find it in the whole apartment. I guess they all are, but especially the two kids are. And they end up finding service over the toilet, which is where the daughter ends up during the sewage flood at the end, just smoking a cigarette, almost as if to say, what am I going to do? I can't stop this flood from happening anyway. I might as well enjoy a cigarette while I still can.
So every set in the film was built from scratch. And the park home was built from scratch on an empty lot and designed by their production designer in conjunction with an architect. And the Kim home, at least the interiors, were in a studio, but they more or less built the street from an abandoned village. They had perfect control over everything. There are some bizarre design things in that home, and one of them is that the toilet is elevated. That gives you two great shots. One where they have to climb up and crouch by the toilet. Can you imagine a worse place to have to hang out? Because you need Wi-Fi.
And they are stealing the Wi-Fi as
yes,
well.
Yes, they are. Well, at least the first two acts of this film, I don't think you could argue that they are the parasites. They are the poor. They absolutely have to hustle to get by. They truly don't have a choice. But they're pretty cunning people. So they get the Wi-Fi up there. And then, of course, the shot later around the end of Act 2, you see Jessica sitting on this exploding toilet just giving up and having a cigarette. It's the only place you can be to be above the sewage that flooded their home.
Okay, so let's talk about a lot of numbers and we'll get back into the conversation here. 99% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes say they like this movie. 418 fresh, 5 rotten. For an average of 9.4 out of 10. Those are outstanding numbers. And 91% of audiences liked it as well. It's 22nd on the IMDb's 250. A lot of movies from last year, and these will eventually come down, I'm sure, as the years go on. But a lot of movies from last year are on the IMDb 250 and highly ranked. I think 1917 is, and so is Ford vs. Ferrari. Not Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, though. Joker, I think, is also really high up, maybe 50 or 60, something like that. But Parasite is 22nd. I mentioned it was 56 last year at the box office, and it keeps on gaining. This is one problem with doing this now, I guess, is we can't have a final number like we would if we did this in August or something. But anyway, Avengers Endgame, of course, is number one. I saw that again just a few days ago. Oh my God, I love that movie so much. What a fantastic end to that whole storyline, and so emotional. Joker, which I've seen twice also, is number nine. We know that's complicated. We talked about that in the Oscar shows, but that was such a monster hit. And 1917, which was Parasite's main competition for the Best Picture Oscar and the one I thought was going to win going into the night, is currently 18th and also, I think, is climbing a little bit because it's still being shown in theaters. I mentioned the four Oscars, picture, director, the original screenplay by Bong and Jin-Won Han. I just call him Bong, didn't I? Anyway, I'm going to do that. You know I'm going to do that. Jin-Won Han, his first screenplay as well, as was the 1917 co-writer with Sam Mendes. Her first ever script, period. Forget a word. It's just first ever screenplay. The guy has worked with Bong before, but that was his
first. Yeah, I think he's one of his production assistants, and he just asked him to take a pass at the script.
It was also nominated for the editing, which would have been a very good choice, although I think it should have been Jojo Rabbit, but it was Ford versus Ferrari. And you just talked about how great those sets were. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood won, and that's a good choice, but maybe it should have been this.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was always going to win because most Academy voters are exactly at the right age where the Hollywood that he depicted, by all accounts, with great accuracy, him and his production designer really created the Hollywood of the late 60s, just as it was. That is going to be a nostalgia bomb. So, of course, just the sheer pleasure of looking at and seeing them nail it is going to be enough to throw them the vote. Plus, I think Parasite's production design can feel a little bit invisible at times because it just looks like interiors of houses and you don't think about all the work and planning that went into the meticulous detail that was created from scratch.
I watched the Best Picture win again. We've talked about this a few times already this year. We did the post show. And it's either Mikey or Mickey. I don't know which it is, but we'll go with Mikey Lee. And she's the little woman that was trying to speak when the lights went down and the microphone was cut out. And then everyone was saying, up, up, let them speak, let them say
great
some more.
Great moment, I loved it.
And she is an executive producer on this film, but a big deal over in South Korea. So it would be like when Harvey Weinstein was at his best, or maybe Spielberg's a better example because people don't hate him. People hated Weinstein before the rape scandal came about. But anyway, she's a big wheel down at the cracker factory, if you will. But she says something. I don't think we listened to this because we were talking to each other during a lot of the speeches, I realize now. I've heard some things in the speeches I don't remember hearing before. So she does something I've talked about whenever it's happened and loved it so much, thanking the audience. She thanked the South Korean audience also for being harsh on them sometimes, for keeping them honest.
Oh, wow.
You almost never hear people that win awards at any awards show say, thank you for watching our movie. So I tip my cap to that, that that's what she wanted to say in the first place. She should have got a chance to speak anyway, but especially when she's going to say something like that.
Just so she could thank you personally.
Not me, but just...
You are the audience, aren't you?
Okay, all of us. But she was thanking her South Korean audience in particular. Neon is one of the production companies that released this picture, did that sick burn on Trump not that long ago, when he was complaining at one of his rallies, how did this win Best Picture? And they say, of course he didn't like it. It has subtitles, and he can't read. And one more thing I'll say here about the awards and stuff. It was the first South Korean film to ever win the Palme d'Or, and it's one of three movies, and this could have been the Coming Attractions trivia, I guess, that won the Palme d'Or and also won Best Picture. Can you guess what they are? They're old. I'll just tell you.
Fudge.
The Lost Weekend and Marty.
Oh, yeah, I never would have.
Taxi Driver could have won, but it won the Palme d'Or, not the Oscar for Best Picture. Pulp Fiction, same thing. They were nominated for Best Picture, but did not win. Let's just relive that night 1 month ago. I wouldn't really call it a shock when it won Best Picture because, as we talked about in that show, once Pong had won for the screenplay, which we weren't surprised about, he'd won the Writers Guild Award, and it seemed like a lock to win the international feature. So it had those two. But once he won for Best Director, and that's such a great speech he gives, but mostly because he gives Scorsese a tribute, and then everybody gives him a standing ovation. I love that moment. Marty seemed really touched by that. He honors Tarantino, the other two directing nominees, Phillips and Mendes.
The other two, he's like, you also made movies. Not that bad, but it definitely, after the glowing, loving tribute he gave to Scorsese and Tarantino, it was a bit of a, and thanks you two also.
And all the rest.
Exactly.
But once he won for Best Director, I said to you, it has to win Best Picture because 1917 wasn't going to win Best Picture without winning for the script, or it wasn't even nominated for any of the actors. Now, that's not a hard and fast rule, but just think of it logically. You don't win Best Picture and win some technicals and that's all. You have to win something major besides Best Picture, like Gladiator won Best Actor. Chicago won for the Supporting Actress. At least it had acting awards before it won Best Picture.
What did Spotlight win? It just won Screenplay, right? And Best Picture?
But that's a big one. If you're not going to win Best Director, but you win Screenplay.
Oh, okay, sure. But at that point, they had already won Screenplay. Parasite had.
Mm-hmm.
And we celebrated so much when it won Screenplay, I didn't actually expect it to win that. And then when it won Director...
The split would have been 1917 Best Director and Parasite Best Picture, not the other way around. So once Parasite won the other one, it had to win the big one.
Yeah, absolutely. But we were celebrating more for those two awards, I think, than when it won Best Picture, because it just seemed like such a done deal by the time that came around.
Yeah. So that wasn't as much of a shock, and I know you're thrilled. So this is your favorite movie of last year, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm firmly on Team Parasite. It's my favorite movie of last year. And I also put it at number 7 on my top of the decade list.
That's right. I didn't put it there. But I didn't love this as much as you did the first time. Now, second viewing, I had a feeling this might happen because I've been hearing so much about this movie as the weeks and months have gone on, when it was getting more and more praise. More and more people were seeing it as well, as we now know. Worldwide. And I was seeing YouTube videos about it, people analyzing and breaking it down. And I thought, I know I liked it. I wouldn't have ever said it wasn't a very good movie, even a great movie, a 3.5-star movie easily. And for what it's worth, I had a 5th from last year. I think I would probably raise it up now if you can read your top 10 list. I guess I should probably. But it was a good year for movies.
It was.
But I didn't really fully buy that ending. But now that I thought about some more, yes, Taxi Driver and Vertigo, we've talked about those plenty of times in our podcasts about how those are fantasy moments. Vertigo, for about half the movie, was your theory from when he's in the asylum to the end of the movie, could all be a fantasy.
Yeah, but in both films, it's never made clear.
No, it's our opinion. We could well be wrong. But then who's right and wrong? It's our opinion. It's our version of the art we're watching. But another film to throw in there is 25th Hour, the Spike Lee film, where Brian Cox is Edward Norton's father, and he's speculating about what could happen if we just keep on driving. I don't take you to jail after all. I take you someplace in the middle of America. No one knows you, and you'd be a different person, and he grows old. That literalizes it completely. Parasite doesn't do it, neither does Taxi Driver, Vertigo. But 25th Hour definitely literalizes that, just a thought of what if, but then it gets back to the car and they keep driving and he's taken them to jail. But I think that's actually the better comparison, Parasite 25th Hour, about...
It sounds very similar.
But if Pong is saying that Ki-woo, Kevin, couldn't have earned enough money to buy the house in many years, many lifetimes really, then he was never going to buy the house. Now, you could also say that's just a fantasy between the two of them, but I think he's dead.
Well, let's say that he's alive, because the movie is saying that he's alive at the end. The point is still that... His fantasy is ridiculous.
Don't stop believing.
You can stop believing. It's never going to happen. And Park Joon-ho very much knows that's never going to happen. And how many times have we been fed this fantasy by Hollywood that somebody really can just be talented enough and clever enough and want it bad enough? That's always the implication. Well, you just work hard enough.
Politicians are worse for this.
Oh, yeah.
I've talked about this a few times, how much I hate Marco Rubio for one thing. That line he had a few years ago, quite a while ago now, I guess. It's the rich and the soon-to-be rich. What is wrong with you
misleading people like that? It's propaganda.
But people buy into that. That's the problem.
Yeah, I know, but it's just put there to make us complacent about our place in the world. Let's talk about the way capitalism is portrayed, and it's obviously the main theme of the film, this issue of class and capitalism. You have the upstairs downstairs thing. There's the stair motif. The Park house is always oriented to be up, and the Kim's house is always down, mostly evident in the flood scene when the Kims are fleeing the higher ground of the Park mansion to go down the stairs to the street level where they go downhill and then down countless stairs on their journey home. Camera pauses on Kevin's feet for a moment, observing all the water that's
rushing down the stairs. Because at first it's just rainwater.
Up in the Park's home, way up in the suburbs where they live, they show this little poignant close-up of the storm drain and all this water rushing to the storm drain. And in that moment, you might be like, well, why would you show that? But then a couple moments later, when you see where all that water is going, it's going into the Kim's neighborhood. And all of their neighbors are being flooded out of their houses. They're floating the doors with their dogs and their babies on it, and they're trying to find higher ground, and they're struggling. And then we see the inside of the Kim's house is absolutely destroyed, of course.
And bad enough it would just be water, but it's also, as the father even says, sewage.
Yeah.
And we record this podcast, by the way, as we always do, in a basement.
We don't live in a basement. Well, we live in a house. A bungalow.
With a half basement, effectively. And we spend a lot of time down here.
Because we have to, because our house is very small. And we're middle class. We do fine. But we can never buy a house in this city because it is too outrageously expensive.
We can also relate to the sewage problems. We've had those in a couple of different houses.
Yeah.
Not so much this one, but the other two we were in together. At least there, that was the basement, and we didn't live in any way in the basement in those houses.
I have lived in a basement apartment before, and if something like that were to happen, it would destroy everything I know, and then where do you go? And shit, literally and figuratively, runs downhill. And maybe one of the most interesting choices that Park Joon-ho makes, the poor characters, both the Kim family and the housekeeper and her husband, it takes them a very long time to turn on the Park family. And they, instead of fighting them and trying to overturn the system that has disadvantaged them so much and given the Park family so much, instead they turn on each other. And they're just fighting for the scraps that are left, fighting for service jobs. Jobs which, I'll be honest, we're middle class people, we had middle class upbringings. If the best I could possibly expect in life was to be a rich person's housekeeper.
Or a driver.
Or a driver.
Or a part-time tutor.
But I guess that speaks somewhat to our own class. We would never accept those jobs, let alone dream of them and consider ourselves as having arrived because we got these amazing jobs serving rich people.
You talked about them turning on, or not turning on the Parks for a long time. The two husbands worship Mr. Park at different points.
Yes.
They both talk about how great he is. And also you've got during that really interesting and pivotal conversation that leads in the big twist about Jun Sei, the guy in the basement. So about him being down there before we even find that out. The Kim family is sitting around drinking and eating the food, and they shouldn't be there. And it makes you wonder, what would happen if the Parks walked in without having called first?
You kind of know it's going to happen. There's no way the Kims or the Parks aren't on their way home. The tension is so there in that moment to begin with.
So they're all talking for a while, but a lot of things happen in that moment, including Mr. Kim speculating about what happened to the driver that he replaced because they screwed him out of his job.
They do bad things, the Kim family.
But he actually seems to be sympathetic. But then not long after, he's grabbing his wife by the shirt, and I don't know how serious it is, threatening to hit her, and she laughs it off, then he laughs it off. The implication of violence is very brief, but it was still there. I've never done that to you. I've never even thought about doing that to you. So it makes me wonder if the movie's saying that if none of this had gone bad, how much longer was that marriage going to be good anyway? Maybe there was this impending violence to begin with.
I read it differently. It's so impossible to believe that he would hit his wife that the moment could only be played for comedy. She plays along with it for a second, and then she just starts laughing. Also, she is a champion shot putter, so there's a good chance she could kick his ass.
Okay, yeah.
She starts laughing, and then they immediately drop it. The kids don't really seem particularly alarmed.
They're all drunk.
They're all drunk. The Kim family seems remarkably and demonstrably happier and closer and just a better family than the Park family.
The kids, actually, even in that scene, are being less gracious than the parents are. But then again, even their mother, Chung Sook, shoves one of the dogs away, who she's around all the time. So either she does not like that dog and probably doesn't, And has to pretend that she does all the time when the parks are around, or she's a bit of an asshole to do that to a dog.
And then she has this wonderful point that she makes. He says the parks are so nice. They're rich, but they're nice. And she says, no, they're nice because they're rich. Money irons out all of your problems. It's easy to be nice when you don't have to struggle. So when they're lamenting about how they took the driver's job away from him, and I don't think they really talk about the housekeeper at that moment, but of course we all know that the housekeeper deserved her job. She was good at her job.
That's when they get really mean. What they do to the driver's bad, yeah. But what they do to the housekeeper's way worse.
It's incredibly selfish and self-serving. That should be something that should lower our opinion of them, because there's nothing the housekeeper does to deserve it up to that point. We have no idea what's going on. She just seems like a perfectly competent, nice employee that doesn't deserve any of this. So we know that they've done bad things. Very early in the film, when we're introduced to them, we see them try to be charming and be duplicitous with the pizza company. We see that Jessica is forging documents to help Kevin get the job. Okay, this family's not exactly on the up and up. But they are nice to each other. They're very loving. They're very close. You feel like they're very much on each other's team. Just the fact that when Kevin gets his job, the very first thing he does is risk that job to get Jessica in there, to get his father in there, and then finally to get his mother in there. And everything they do risks his position, but he's doing it for his family because they are just tight-knit like that. Whereas the Park family, first of all, you really called into question whether or not Mr. Park even loves Mrs. Park.
I don't think he does.
No, of course he doesn't. He gets asked twice. Directly, well, you love your wife, right? This answer is very,
I guess.
Of course I love her. So noncommittal. The kids seem to actively hate them. The teenage daughter is being very teenage daughtery, storming around, hates her mom.
The son runs the house.
The son runs the house.
He's a tyrant.
There's a cute little thing with him and his dad where they have the walkie-talkies and stuff.
But the son's in charge.
They have this crazy dynamic, and you just don't feel that warmth and that closeness.
If you don't want your kid to be outside in a blazing rainstorm, pounding rainstorm, you make him come in, and if he doesn't handle it well, oh well, you are, what, 4 years old, 5 years old?
That mom is terrified of her son.
Even the father is, though, because he could just grab him by the arm and say, get in the house, it's raining out there, and staying in a tent and making us stay down here to watch over you. That leads to the sex scene. We'll get back to that in a second. That was actually a great scene. But about the kid's artistry, do you think there's any actual talent there, or is that just his mother imagining there is? And then, of course, Ki Young, Jessica, is faking. Another movie I've talked about this so many times in our podcast over the years, I love when characters in a movie have to act, and these guys, all four of them, do that. We also see the really excellent cutting back and forth, another reason why this movie could have won for the editing, when the father's being coached by the son on how to sell the whole peach thing, don't oversell it. And obviously there was other times they had to do that when they got their jobs in the first place.
There's a great video essay, my nerd writer, a guy that we love, makes amazing video essays, and he made an essay about that exact montage that you're talking about. It's basically them working out how to finally oust the housekeeper and take over all the service jobs in the home.
Okay, so back to my point, though. Is Dahai, the kid, actually a good artist? Or is mother full of crap? And it is, of course, Ki Jung. She is, but is she just completely making this up? The whole thing about the bottom right corner shows chaos.
She admits she's making it up.
She could have studied that, though, and found that was true.
Well, it's clear that she's very bright. She says that she looked it up, and then she just ad-libbed. But I think she's just making it all up, and the mom is just so naive.
So there you go.
Anything.
They're pandering to the kid even more. He's not even really a talented artist.
Okay, but here's my point. The paintings that they chose to put up to represent the kid's art, Pong Joon-ho and the production designer created, it's hard to believe those were created by an 8-year-old. They're very good. They're better than what most 8-year-olds would do. So maybe they're actually trying to imply, yeah, this kid is a talented artist.
Okay. I didn't think they were that great.
It's kind of irrelevant whether he's actually a good artist or not.
Oh, I don't know. This movie's full of great details. This will not be a short podcast because of things like that. You mentioned briefly that they were making pizza boxes for a pizza place, and that's the job they have. That must bring pennies into the house at best, and they don't even do it very well. I like how their boss, just a contact, I guess, the pizza place, I don't think she has any real power at the pizza place, but she's their boss, says that a quarter of the boxes aren't done well. So that likely means one of them is not doing it right. I wonder which one it is. Doesn't seem to be clear which one of them is doing them wrong.
Oh, yeah. Who's the weak link?
But there must be
good
at least
point.
One of them.
I never put that together, but yeah, one quarter of them are incorrect.
But this is a movie about food. Did you think about that?
There's
the pizza box thing, obviously, I'd say food restaurant. Food restaurant? Anyway. There are many meals in the movie. The peach stuff, which comes back later on. When Ki Jung runs to the fridge, when they're all scrambling for that phone, I wonder where she was going exactly. And then when she goes in the fridge, you think, what in the world? Why are you grabbing a knife? Ah, she's grabbing the peaches that they can now have in the house. That's a great setup and payoff. This movie is full of great setup and payoff in so many ways. It's Back to the Future-esque in a lot of ways. And that's one of them because she rubs them on Moon Gwang's face, and that might as well be a knife. It's probably even more effective than a knife would be because she's messed up pretty fast on the peaches. But there's a lot of food. Of course, the reason why Mrs. Park calls and gives them the opportunity to basically get out of that situation, they never are found out that they were all there partying in their house and they're all family members. Not that way, at least. The Parks may be found out later on. Well, at least Mrs. Park, because Mr. Park died. Anyway. But she calls ahead because she wants Chung-suk to make Ramdon.
Ramdon, which is apparently the kid. An English bastardization.
And the kid doesn't even want it. But if it weren't for that food, the Parks would have gone home as normal and the Kims would have been caught. The Kims are almost caught anyway.
Another bizarre food detail is that when the housekeeper first goes down to find her husband, when we first discover that he's down there, she's bringing him food. And she brings him, I didn't notice this the first time I saw the film, a man-sized baby bottle, but it has a baby bottle nipple on it, and he's sucking on it, and she's rubbing his belly. I need to dive deep and find some interviews where he talks about what happened to that man, that he became completely crazy and infantilized. Obviously, you have cabin fever and whatever's going on there.
That's why, I think.
Yeah, and then they have this hero worship of the Parks, but how he became truly like an infant while he was down there. There's also stuff like the plum juice, plum extract, which apparently is like a luck thing, has something to do with good fortune. The last time we see that is when the guy from the basement comes up and he's drinking it straight from those giant jars and he smashes it on the ground. Jessica gets stabbed when she's carrying a birthday cake.
Yeah, the whole thing is about food, of course.
The birthday cake, of course, is what the kid was eating when he saw the demon.
That's a great image. I went to the washroom during this movie, but I did not remember that until I started seeing it online the last few months when people were raving about this film. And I thought, is that a horror movie scene that they're saying is in Parasite? What are they talking about? And then I saw more clips and realized, okay, it wasn't just one person saying it. A lot of people are. I don't remember seeing that before. But I paid more attention this time, and that is a great moment. Well, of course, the Far East, Korea, I guess in some cases, obviously Japanese movies. So much J-horror over there. Well, the Koreans did too, not just the Japanese. And that is straight out of a horror film, that moment. And that would have freaked out the kid, and then he has a seizure, which of course is what happens at the end in the barbecue. I like that the very first thing you see in the whole movie are socks and underwear hanging in the basement apartment. And then we, of course, meet the family, and we see what's going on. And they're also being assholes too, to the guy who's peeing. Now, I'm with them on this. You shouldn't be peeing in basically somebody's backyard and out in public, too. Find a washroom. Although, as we know, in big cities like this one, it's not easy to find washrooms sometimes. When we were in Boston a couple of years ago, we couldn't find a washroom. We had to go in the Starbucks. And
yeah.
I don't even drink Starbucks. You had to buy me a water just by an excuse to be in the Starbucks. They're being dicks to somebody who's lower class. Maybe he is. Maybe he's not. We don't really know. He's just drunk. But probably lower class than they are. So it's not just about how the Parks treat people badly, and I don't think they do. We'll get to that in 1 second. But the Kims are capable of doing it too, and they do. Not just their conning of people, but looking down their noses at people. Well, they're doing it as well. Okay, I just said it. The Parks being dicks. I don't think that they are. I know a lot of people probably would. I've criticized Rich many times, and I'll do it a lot more times in our podcast and in our lives as well. But in this portrayal, in 2 hours of this movie, I think the way the Parks are portrayed is, yes, they're rich, and they're not the greatest people in the world, but they're just more oblivious.
Yeah, they're absolutely oblivious.
And they're not mega rich. They're not the kind of people that know damn well, like the Koch brothers, what's going on in the world. Well, the Koch brother now, the other one's dead. Bye. Good riddance to you. But these are the kinds of people that have a lot of money and can live well, like you said before, but they're not jerks. If they knew what was happening to that family, and of course the jig would be up if they found out the family were all together, and they were, anyway, if they knew what had happened to them, they would probably sympathize. They would fire them, yes. But if they knew what had happened, they would not be indifferent the way a lot of mega rich people seem to be. I just think they're oblivious, especially Mrs. Park.
One of the details that I thought was neat, especially second time I'm watching this film, about the Parks is all the poor people that live or work, I should say, inside the Park home are in reverence of this home. Especially the housekeeper and her husband. They just talk about this glowing love for this place. But the Parks seem to just treat it like an everyday house. They don't really think about it. They just live in it. The kids storm up the stairs because they're mad at their mom. And it's bizarre. I've seen houses like this in Architectural Digest documentaries about falling water. I see houses like this, but they're always pristine and perfect like museums. And it feels so strange to just see a family living in it. But I think it's a representation of how they take their lifestyle for granted. And I agree with you. They're nice people. They're not bad people. They just look after themselves the same way you and I do and the way that the Kims do. They care, of course, more about their own family. She's going to fire her housekeeper because she's worried that she has tuberculosis and that she's going to spread it to her children, who she has so much anxiety about.
She's conned into it, but you can understand her completely doing that.
And they're also living exactly the way that society tells them to live. Like, every message in the world tells them to just take care of their own family, enjoy the wealth that they feel that they earned.
They are job creators.
Yeah, I don't agree with that concept in that statement, But I can see how they just believe that they've already done their part by being so awesome and successful, so they don't really owe anybody else anything. And if you want a good parallel for anybody who's feeling particularly smug about this right now, we do fine. In the scheme of the world, we actually are doing great.
Yeah, we're mega rich.
But yeah, by Canada standards, we're middle class. By world standards, we're way upper class.
Exactly.
We sit here and complain about where we're at, but we don't really think about the Kim families that we step on to get here. We enjoy all the labor in China and Vietnam, Bangladesh, that gets us all of our cheap clothes
this
and
iPad
our
I'm
gadgets,
looking at.
This iPad we're looking at. These were built on the backs of the poor, and we enjoy it, and we don't think about it. We would be annoyed if this came in our backyard and started making a fuss in our face and started living in our basement. We'd be like, what the hell do you think you're doing? This is my basement.
As far as taking that house for granted, that is so human nature.
Yeah.
Because we've been in some nice houses, people we've known, and even some family members. My brother-in-law, years ago, had almost disdain for his house.
His mansion.
And I'll quote Chris Rock about the O.J. Simpson thing. If I had this house, I wouldn't kill nobody. Now, there's no killing. Well, actually, there is killing in this movie, not with my brother-in-law. But the point being that you get used to what you have, and I don't think that that makes the rich people worse in that way. It's just human nature, because most people would be like that. Nobody sits around in something they get used to and marvels at it all the time. People that will post pictures of a beautiful sunset or their backyard if they happen to have a lot of space or something like that, or an outstanding garden, whatever it is, or a great house like the Parks have, marvel about it at times, maybe for a long time, but not always, because it becomes the norm. It's like eating your favorite food all the time. It wouldn't be your favorite food for very much longer because you get used to it, because that's human nature. We talked about the good luck rock that Kiwu gets early on. That's supposed to bring wealth. Well, a good luck rock is also a theme in Uncut Gems from last year.
Oh, yeah, big time.
And Kevin Garnett, the basketball player, ends up with that rock. And it's a great line, actually, towards the end of the movie where he's talking about, get me the rock or something like that. In basketball, that's what they call the ball. So it's a double meaning in that movie.
It's funny, you really could make another version of Uncut Gems just from his perspective of all the things he has to do to get this stone, this MacGuffin, you know, that he's obsessed with.
You mean
with.
Kevin Garnett.
Kevin Garnett, yeah.
Another super rich person dealing with somebody who's desperate and scrambling, but also Adam Sandler's character is not poor compared to most people in the world. Like you just said a minute ago, the Kims, compared to a lot of people in South Korea, God knows everywhere all around the world, the Kims even are doing pretty well compared to them.
So because when their house gets flooded out, they have a gymnasium to go to. There are parts of the world where people get flooded out and there's no gymnasium to go to. They are just screwed and they're on their own and they're struggling and they're fighting people for scraps.
And as far as they know, they still have jobs. They do until the next day.
That is a turning point. From that moment on, nobody's enamored with the Parks. Nobody thinks that the Parks are so great.
Do you think Mr. Park is being a dick to make Mr. Kim wear the headdress and all the rest of that? And then the way he treats him when the chaos happens and Ki-jung gets killed. He doesn't know who she is to him. And he's worried about his son who just had a seizure. And he doesn't know why, because he doesn't know who this guy is that came out with blood in his face and stabs his son's art teacher. In that chaos, Mr. Park is being a dick to Mr. Kim. But I get why. Because he doesn't know the whole story. And if he did, we'll worry about the whole ramifications. You guys lying to us and conning your way into these jobs and hurting people in the process, including the old housekeeper, really conning her out of her job. But I think this movie is fair to the Parks and Mr. Park. Even at his worst moment, when he's an ass to Mr. Kim, I understand why.
Totally agree. I think a lot of people might see it a different way.
I think they will.
Only because the film does set up and establish that Mr. Park thinks pretty high of himself and has this borderline contempt for the poor. At least insofar as he's like, I don't want them to inconvenience me in any way, even if that smallest way is that when they ride the subway, they sometimes have a certain smell. Or, you know, when their whole neighborhood gets flooded with sewage, they have a certain smell, and I don't like it, it offends my nose. That makes him not as nice of a person.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody who thinks that they don't do that in any way, under any circumstances, is lying
exactly.
to themselves.
There are notices all around where I work about don't wear offensive smells, and that was more about perfumes. I think I know the guy who had a problem with it, and it seemed like it was a bit of a racial thing. But those notices are still up there. I've never had a sense of smell. If I were to fart or you were to fart, I don't smell it. Curry or some kind of bad food, a little bit of a sewage problem, I just wouldn't know it's there. So I can't relate to his issue with that. Yes, he's being an asshole about that. So I'm not trying to forgive him entirely. But that makes him more human that he is like that. But it's also a running theme because at one point the kid says, oh, this guy, the driver, smells like the housekeeper. And then everyone just seems to ignore that. You could argue they're poor, so they just smell alike.
Well, they live in the same house, and you and I, our clothes probably
smell. Well, the driver shouldn't smell like the housekeeper, though. Except that
they do. No, it's the mom. It's his wife. That's who he smells like. Because then they're having a conversation later where they were like, should we use different detergent?
Mr. and Mrs. Kim, he's smelling.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, this is the problem with the names.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yes, I said it before. He goes from the driver to the housekeeper. Why do you smell the same? And everyone just blows that off. But that should have been the jig being up. But then the smell thing comes back later on, because that's why. And this is one of the things I don't buy. There's a few things about this movie I don't buy. I do buy the ending now. The fantasy sequence, the 25th hour taxi driver thing. Fine. That's interesting. That's how we interpret that. But I don't buy a few things about that last day in the movie. The climactic barbecue. Why the mother invite the tutor and the art teacher over? A little bit spurious. Yeah, they've gotten close to them. And Kevin Kiwoo has gotten close to the daughter and is interested in her, just like his friend was before. He even uses some of the same lines that Min, his friend, had used before. So I guess I'll give you that, but it's a little bit spurious that he get invited. More spurious that Jessica Ki-jung would be invited, I think. But then she's the one that's killed. I guess you needed her to be there to get killed. But then what puts Mr. Kim over the edge is when the smell thing comes up all over again. I guess he's upset, understandably, that his house has been ruined. But Mr. Park didn't have anything to do with that. And then Mr. Park even says, you're being paid to dress in this headdress. You're being paid overtime right now. That is the job. I understand Mr. Park's point of view. And I don't really buy that Mr. Kim would be that upset. Yes, his daughter just got killed by some guy that, well, he knows who the guy is, actually. He's one of the only people in that party that knows who the guy is that just killed his daughter. But for him to go and just stab Mr. Park the way he does, I don't really buy it.
I agree with you. I do feel that moment is not earned. When Mr. Kim turns on Mr. Park, it's one thing for him to turn on him, but for him to murder him?
The night before, he was the one that was raving about the guy.
Yeah, and he's just a sweet guy. At no point do you really feel like he's capable of violence. That's why I say, even when he grabs his wife by the lapel, I'm like, yeah, this isn't this guy. So I don't buy it. I think that's just an error of the film that's not quite sold properly. But when it comes to the smell thing, there's a couple of incidents before this where the smell comes up. They overhear them when they're hiding under the table.
Yep.
And he's talking about the way poor people smell. And then, of course, he smells himself. And there is a moment in his performance where you can tell there's something that right then, there, in that moment, that has really gotten under his skin. Suddenly, he feels quite bothered by that. And then, again, when he's driving, and then it's the wife that's in the car. She's got her feet in his face. Her shoes are off. Her bare feet are up on the passenger seat, so they are a foot away from his face, and she's the one that has the nerve to be like, ew, pee, ew. And he catches her do it, and you can see in his face, there's this heartbroken thing, and there's this moment there where he's like, oh, this is how they see me. Contempt is the wrong word. It's more like this total dismissiveness.
Yeah.
There's the way that they feel there's so much above it. And so when the third time it happens, it's more a representation of how he comes to understand that he is dirt to them.
But to go to murder.
I totally agree with you that it's a stretch to believe that, especially that character. I'm not surprised that the housekeeper's husband goes and kills somebody. He's crazy from the get-go. He has gone all the way around the
bend. And he's just killed, probably, Kevin in the basement.
I would almost believe it more if the mother of the Kim family were to kill somebody. She just seems a little bit more edgy. She seems more capable of it than her husband does.
She's the only one that's left standing at the end of this movie from that family, if what we think is true is what happened.
I guess we should treat it like Kevin is actually alive at the end, because that is totally what the movie shows us. He's the last character you see on screen.
I don't think he is.
If it was his dad's fantasy, then I feel like they would end on a shot of his dad. Although it's very important to end on the shot of the apartment. Not only have they not improved their situation at all, but they're worse off than they were.
The mother's before. Cleaning the place at that time.
Yeah, well, or still earlier, cleaning maybe. The sewage yeah. off, probably.
Which is never really going to be fully clean. How could it be? Well, we only talked a little bit about that middle sequence, but there's so much that happens when that great twist, one of the great twists ever, especially a mid-movie twist. It'd be one thing if it was the last 5-10 minutes, Sixth Sense, Psycho-type twist at the very end where the whole movie gets called into question when you think, oh my God, this is what it was all about? Well, in this movie, we find out there's been a guy in the basement the whole time. But it's set up really well earlier where, I think as Mr. Park says, Moon Gwang eats for two because she's stealing food for her husband. And then Yun Kyo, Mrs. Park, says that Moon Gwang knows this house better than I do. Which is important about the basement, because none of the Parks know that that panic room is even down there.
She worked for the architect beforehand.
Right.
When she first starts going down the stairs, I thought it was the architect down there.
And you said a minute ago about the coffee table, when the father and the two kids, the Kims, are under there for, must be hours, or at least probably an hour. And that great mutual masturbation scene happens. You might see a little bit of boob there with the wife, right?
Yeah, maybe. I didn't catch it if you do.
But it's more about suggesting what they're really doing. And it's one of the sexier things I've seen in a movie in a while. Chris and I always talk about, can you score at this movie? I think so. At least at that moment, you sure can.
Well, she seems very quickly into it. And it's funny because she's like, cut it out. What if he comes in? But she's so obviously turned on by what he's doing.
But they're not taking their clothes off, though. So that's got to help a little bit. That if he does come in, they could probably see him coming from that tent. But then also they can just quickly take their hands away.
What do you think that scene serves? Why put a sex scene there? What do you think Bong Joon-ho
is illustrating? To turn me on. It's like a Mulholland Drive, their sex scene.
It's like, I know what my audience wants. To humiliate the Kims a little more and put them in an even more awkward position.
But not by any means deliberate, because the Parks don't know the Kims are there.
No, and it actually puts them in a more perilous position, because at this point, if they emerge from the coffee table, not only have they been hiding, not only do they have so much explaining to do, but now they've just sat there and quietly listened to them do a sex act, which is such an invasion of privacy that they could get into even more trouble. I mean, they already would lose their jobs, but you could totally see Mrs. Park trying to get the police involved.
But before the Parks even come home, of course, the big twist with Moon Gwang and her husband, and they're all fighting over the phone at one point. I like how, and I even took a note, and then literally the husband calls it a nuclear weapon, and I took down a note that it's like a gun, because she's holding the phone at them, ready to press the send button with this picture to the Parks, and they back off like she's got a loaded weapon at them. It's a really cool moment. I think played for a comedy. This movie's not hilarious, but it is funny at times.
It's got some funny stuff.
And we're going to talk about this in our movie next week, a movie that manages to have all kinds of tones be mixed and matched. One of the reasons why a director ever is successful in a film and makes a good movie, if they're going to do this at all, not every movie does this, if you're going to mix tones and finding a way to maintain that, and this movie does have some satire, and that's a great moment where I could see myself laughing out loud the next time I see this movie when I know it's coming, because I will have seen the strings a little bit more and understand it.
I found it funnier in my second viewing, for sure.
Okay, there you go. But also there's a lot of suspense. People have called this movie Hitchcockian. And of course, Hitchcock thought all of his movies are comedies. And Scorsese seems to think half his movies are comedies. You listen to his commentaries, a lot of times he's laughing at things. That's funny to you, Marty? Okay. So maybe Pong's just got the same kind of sick sense of humor that his idol and Hitchcock do.
I like the mention of the H-bomb. Several times in the film, they talk about North Korea. North Korea, right, and South Korea had a civil war. They probably have essentially a Red Scare. Imagine the Red Scare of living in South Korea and always having the threat of North Korea. And these people would have grown up with that threat. That's why the bunker is below the house. In the first place, the architect put it there because they were worried that North Korea would bomb them. So it's like a fallout shelter. And that's why it's so far under the ground. And then she does her great impression of North Korean. I love it. Her impression of North Korean, right, newscaster. Their ass-kissing propaganda. But the presence is always there. And then it could be the implication of, well, as bad as they are, they're still better off than North Koreans. North Koreans are literally starving. They, as far as we know, have some of the worst lives in the entire world right now.
And it was a reasonable request to let Jin-se live down there for good. After all, the Kims are lying too. And they seem to be judging Moon Gwang for lying about this whole thing and not just basically saying, we'll look the other way. Because all she wants to do is take care of her husband. She doesn't want anything from them. She's not trying to extort them. Maybe they're worried that she will. I do think this movie has got all kinds of suggestions, like we've talked about in some of Tarantino's movies, like Pulp Fiction, where if you really follow the threads and think, what would have happened in this moment if the bad thing didn't happen? Like the overdose in Pulp Fiction, for example. What would have really happened? Probably a sex scene or God knows whatever with those two characters, Travolta and Thurman. But in this film, I think one of the things that definitely would have happened is Park was probably going to fire Mr. Kim for the whole smell thing. Forget all the rest that came with the basement stuff and the party and the murders. If life had just gone on as normal, he fired people for less.
Yeah, for the smell thing and because he crossed the line, something they bring up more than once, by asking him personal questions about how he feels about his wife. You can tell how uncomfortable that makes him. And that he always likes his staff to remember their place. That's very important to him.
Which, again, I can't believe I'm actually backing up a wealthy person. But I understand that. Because if
that's
they're
the
your staff, that's your job.
That's what this film
Shut
does
up
so
and do
well.
Your job.
You can understand where Mr. Park is coming from. I don't want my barista to ask me personal questions when I'm picking up my coffee. And I wouldn't want my Uber driver to ask me if I love my husband.
A better example would be your producer. Getting too personal. Maybe some of your producers that you know really
well.
Well,
yeah,
now.
It's a terrible example because we have very intimate conversations sometimes in that edit bay. Let me tell you, when that door closes, people can really tell you.
Okay, you
stuff.
Do, but there are people that I work with. Well, I don't work with them the same way that they do in this movie because I work alone, but there are some people I've worked with indirectly or directly for a long time. If they're asked some of the questions that Mr. Kim asked Mr. Park, maybe I would take it okay, but a lot of people wouldn't. And you're actually working with that person. So you mentioned baristas. Well, you don't know them. You've seen them for minutes. I'm talking about somebody you deal with all the time, maybe for years. So this not crossing the line thing is actually pretty understandable. Now, one thing we didn't talk about before is just how devious, because they all are, obviously, but just how devious Ki Jung is, Jessica. She plants her underwear after the first meeting with the family. I guess she knows she has the job, but she plants that underwear to help get the driver fired to get their father hired right away.
Yeah.
It isn't after being there for a week or even a couple of days. It's the first day.
Maybe it's when they're trying to oust the housekeeper. They say, oh, are we already moving on to the next phase of the plan? As in, they always had a plan from the beginning of how they were going to infiltrate the house. And they often compliment her as being the most devious one. But then there's also a line when they're all drinking together where they say, of all four of us, you're the one that fits in the best. You're the one that I could see actually living here.
That's She's flat out mean, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. And she seems to have the least scruples, the sharpest, most cunning mind when it comes to the schemes. When she picks up that peach, it's almost sexy, and she's blowing the things into the air. You can see her relishing in this plan to oust the housekeeper, which is 100% cruel and selfish act.
Mm. Yeah, it's probably the meanest thing they do, outside of what happens at the very end when murders are taking place. It's one of the more, not violent, but really awful acts. We saw
it's violent. Cause her to have a violent allergic reaction.
We think of violence with knives and guns.
Sure, but they harm her.
The big movies last year, so many of them were about violence. And I guess maybe every year the big movies for Oscars, because so many of them end up being old war films, like 1917 or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has a lot of violence, of course.
But we already talked about how a lot of the big films this year had very dominant themes of class. This obviously Knives Out. You could definitely say that about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Definitely.
It's about an actor and his employee.
Well, also Rick himself that doesn't fit in with Sharon Tate until he's told her this whole story and then she welcomes him in. And I think that movie's got a great ending. And one of the suggestions is that maybe he's going to be in their circle and maybe he'll get work with Roman Polanski because Sharon Tate seems like she's so nice that she'd help
him out.
I think
that's totally what's implied.
But before any of that happens, he's just their neighbor. They don't even know. And they're not trying to exclude him from their lives and not include them because she's a very inclusive person. But she's not really aware of him, which is kind of what happens in this movie. The Parks and the Kims, well, more so the Parks to the Kims, they are literally aware of them, obviously, but they're not aware of them.
Oh, another great detail. Parks have the luxury of being able to be oblivious to the Kims and what's going on in their life and all poor people in Seoul. But it's remarkable how much the Kims are adept at fitting in with rich people. They know exactly how to act. They know what to pretend, which schools they went to. They know that it's very prestigious to have appeared to live in America, to have American names. The way they dress remarkably differently when they're dressing for the Parks than they dress for themselves. It's very much code switching. But the fact is they can speak the language of the rich. Whereas the rich, you can imagine, have no idea how to speak the language of the poor. It would never occur to them to want to try to fit in with that. But it's just another skill that the poor have to get by in this world.
Reminds me, too, when you hear people like Jennifer Lopez. I'm still Jenny from the Block. When she did that song after she'd already become rich and famous, even before she got to be mega rich and mega famous when she started making music, just making movies like Selena and Out of Sight when she was well off, not super rich
yet. Before that, she was in Hollywood. She was a fly girl.
Right. You're not Jenny from the Block anymore. You're not poor and begging for stuff anymore.
Ryan, don't be fooled by the rocks she's got.
I do think that's interesting when rappers or actors or whoever, musicians, will make that claim. I'm still street. No, you're not. You just aren't. I haven't struggled that much in my life, but whatever struggle I ever had before, I'm not struggling now. Look at my waistline. I think the proof is there. So Jensei, I think I'm saying his name wrong, but the guy in the basement has been down there for over 4 years. The end of the film does seem to be saying, whatever we interpret is really going on, that Mr. Kim did go down there and is living down there. How long is he going to be down there?
Forever. He'll never
Forever
leave.
Forever and ever and ever. Two Shining references in this podcast.
You want to talk about what happens next? He's done for.
I think what happens next is the two remaining Kims, well, maybe the one with just the mother, but if it is the two remaining Kims, so the son and the mother, they go back to working shitty jobs for the rest of their lives because you can't put this on your resume that you did work for the Parks, obviously. And then Mrs. Park marries another rich man because she's helpless without one. Another funny sequence where we see she can't even work a dishwasher.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So this is where the tables turn and then the Parks become the parasites because without the hard work of the Kims and theoretically all poor people that do jobs for wealthier people, they would be absolutely helpless. They can't cook, they can't wash dishes, they can't even drive.
They can barely take care of their children.
Yeah.
Without the expert help, not expert, but the supposedly expert help of the daughter, who's the best con artist of this whole family. But that's talked about in the only featurette that's on the Blu-ray, where Pong talks about the rich leech off of the poor with their labor. And of course, more literally in this movie for a long time, it's the poor leeching off of the rich.
my iPhone only costs $1,000. If it was made in Canada, it would cost $3,000 or $4,000.
Usually we talk about the actors in more specific detail, but we don't really know these actors, except for the father and the son with the Kims. I will mention some details about them. Kang Ho-song, who plays Mr. Kim, was in The Host, which, of course, Bong Joon-ho directed, and Snowpiercer, which I just watched on Netflix a few days ago again. He's a key part of that film. So he's worked with Bong several times, and apparently if he'd said no, would have been a deal breaker, and Bong wouldn't have made the movie. He wanted him that badly. Wow. And I guess he is the main character. It's an ensemble piece. And Woo Sik Choi, who does play his son, Ki Woo, Kevin, in this, was in a really good horror film about zombies done differently than you've probably ever seen before. And it is on Netflix, last I looked. Train to Busan, or Busan, I think it's pronounced Busan. I think it's a Korean film.
He's
Korean.
Heard of it. So. Yeah.
And then he was in Okja, which Pong did before this film, which I've seen. It's on Netflix. Thought it was okay. Didn't love it. And I think I said this already recently. Part of the problem was it made me feel guilty about eating meat.
I don't like feeling guilty.
I didn't think the movie is as good as this one, or even Snowpiercer, though, as well. So Pong directed The Host and Snowpiercer and Okja, and he's got a pretty impressive resume anyway. He hadn't done a Korean film, though, in about 10 years. It wasn't even The Host, it was Mother, I believe. So not the one we covered, the Darren Aronofsky film, but just a different kind of Mother. About 2009, I think, is when that came out. Pong calls this movie a tragic comedy. I don't know if it's funny enough to call it a comedy, but like I just said, Hitchcock thought things were funny. Like in Psycho, he thought that movie was hilarious, apparently. James Whale, we're going to talk about him next week, thought his movies were hilarious, and he mostly did actual horror films, which in that era were pretty scary to people. But definitely the tragedy part fits. And we already said, there's a lot of good satire and even some flat-out laughs in this movie. And there are a lot of running themes, like people watching through windows, the staircases you mentioned already, and then just the suspense in general, because once we find out what's going on in that basement, if you could predict where this movie's going to go, then you are a sorcerer, because I wouldn't have known. Not only not seeing that twist coming, but not knowing where that's going to take things in the future. If you'd stopped this movie when I saw it in the theater and said, Ryan, how's it going to end? I wouldn't have said what happened at all. And some of the things I think don't work entirely. Like we said, some of the people that were at that party that shouldn't have been, and Mr. Kim going hog wild and murderous. I don't really buy that entirely. But just the idea that it pays off, and so many of those setups and payoffs work out so well. And all in the end ends up being about those two houses. And when the Kims in that what might be fantasy sequence, the remaining, the three of them, all hug when he comes back and he comes from the basement. And by the way, he can't really live normally because he'd still be wanted for murder.
No, it's
I think
true.
Even in Korea, it's like over here. That's a crime you're always having to worry about. It's not like it's a statute of limitations. But before it fades to black and then goes to that last shot of Kevin in the semi-basement, as the mother's coming to join the hug, it fades out before she even gets there.
Yeah, it's a curious touch.
As if to say, she's not really part of this, because the last bit is about the father and son and their exchange.
Yeah, it's curious to focus on that relationship. I'm not sure. Maybe on a third watch of the film, I'll look for details that make that make sense. Because one of the best things about this film is it's incredibly intentional. Bong Joon-ho is one of those directors who is meticulous and pays very close attention to detail in the sense that you can trust it and you can watch it over and over again and expect that every line in the script, every painting on the wall, every item of clothing that they're wearing was meticulously chosen to reflect
something.
The themes, and it means something, or it connects back with one scene or another.
Did you notice how often, I wouldn't say it's constantly, but there's a fair amount of times where we hear them speak English. It's still subtitled, but they use English phrases, and not just one word.
Well, Kevin is an English tutor as well.
But it's not him necessarily saying it. At one point, Mrs. Park does. I think a few times, in fact, she uses English phrases. Just one at a time. It's not like she speaks a whole monologue in English.
She also has the whole thing where she thinks something is good if it's American.
Okay.
Which, of course, capitalism. She says several times, these toys must be good. They came from America.
And
they
the
must
tent
be good.
Did too.
And the tent came from America. So, of course, it's going to be waterproof. It's American. And, of course, the fact that their son is obsessed with Indians, something that would be a bizarre thing for a kid to be into here and now.
We talked about
North
The
America.
Shining a few times just in joking references, but that movie's got a subtext about the natives as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah. But I wonder if a kid in Canada was growing up and was obsessed with, I know this isn't Korean, it's Japanese, but we're obsessed with, say, ninjas. I wonder if it would be kind of the same sort of thing where it's this cartoonish version of a cultural archetype.
Right, yeah. So Pong wrote the movie with Jin-Won Han. Pong always writes his own movies. He's one of those true auteurs that way, like Tarantino, one of his competitors for 3 Oscars this year. Picture, director, and the original screenplay. Tarantino was up for all 3 of those.
I don't know if he's spoken about it, but I bet Tarantino would not be mad about losing to this movie. It seems like exactly the kind of thing that Tarantino loves.
Well, when Pong referenced him in his Oscar speech, he mentioned about how Tarantino had
always... that's right. He's been a champion.
Champion
his
of
films.
His other
yeah,
films.
Yeah, that's right.
So the movie's 2/3/9/1. We, of course, saw our brand new Blu-ray. The cinematographer was Kyung Pyo Hong, who shot Mother and Snowpiercer. which is a very good-looking movie, of course, as is this. The editor, Jinmo Yang, cut Train to Busan and Okja, and the composer, Jael Jung, did music for Okja. So I think you're going to say the look and the cutting and the music were pretty excellent, right? Across
they
the board?
They are immaculate.
We definitely didn't cover everything you can in this movie, but I feel like that's probably a good place to end it. When we watch this movie again, we'll definitely discover even more details. It's one of those kinds of films that rewards repeat viewings. If I had to re-rank my top 10 last year, it would raise up. It's number one on your list, and here we are covering it a month after the Oscars. So your last thoughts on Parasite.
How often does a film come along that unites the way Parasite does? I don't know one person who hated it, and even people who were a little meh about it have been able to take part in these stirring discussions about what it all means. Also, I think even on top of its quality as a film, it is a perfect movie for this time and place. Mm-hmm. It reflects an anxiety about capitalism that I think every single person, rich or poor, can relate to right now in the year 2020.
And as good as the other movies up for Best Picture last year were, like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in 1917, Marriage Story as well. Maybe that one, I guess, fits in with the themes. But actually, not really. Joker, actually, for whatever its flaws are, does. But yeah, that's one of the reasons I think it won. It really latched on for people. And even the rich people at the Oscars, they all seemed to love it. They were the ones that were saying, like Tom Hanks, for example, then I can and let these people say some more. And it seemed like a truly magnanimous gesture. You talked about how people don't hate this film. Only 5 rotten reviews out of 423 on Rotten Tomatoes. Now, that's not the be-all and end-all. But those numbers I talked about earlier, including its box office, it's being loved in almost every way it can be. And it looks like it might be a long-term classic. And also ended the decade with another 8 Best Picture winner. Spotlight, Moonlight, oh, yeah. Parasite. All right, in 7 days, we're going to cover another film that mixes tones very well. The camp horror classic, Bride of Frankenstein. The coming attractions trivia for Bride of Frankenstein, which took me a lot of digging. So I don't expect anyone to actually get this, but here we go. It's hard to do what Bride of Frankenstein does in combining humor with horror, or just thrills in general. It was one of 15 movies to be nominated for AFI's Top 100 Laughs and the Top 100 Thrills. I thought it was going to be more like 4 or 5 that were like that, and I kept going, and there's another one, another one, another one. Some of them are really well-known titles, though. Some are not. Of the other 14 films that were nominated for the Laughs and the Throws list, how many were directed by the same person? There's at least one. There may be more. I did all that work. That was going to be the question.
And so for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Bride of Frankenstein. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. And while you're there, perhaps you could rate us and review us. Ryan and I are both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project, and that's all one word, top100project, and it's not case sensitive, for a 20% discount.
Well, I think we should have a kid, and that kid can grow up really quickly, and then they can get us out of the semi-basement that we're in right now. Get us in a mansion, kid. Sam, you're not doing anything. Well, I'm tired. He's so lazy. All right, wrap it.
Okay, cut.